हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे रामा हरे रामा राम रामा हरे हरे। Hare Krishna. Thank you for coming today. And can you go to slide 18, I think. Slide 18. Okay, we'll just go over the summary then. So I explained last time about how our modes affect our moods. So the same thing which seems awesome and can become awful later. The modes are subtle forces that shape the interaction between matter and consciousness. In the mode of goodness, we think before we act. In passion, we act, then we think. In ignorance, there is simply neither proper action nor proper thinking. There is simply delusion. And within us, the mind is like a screen which integrates the inputs coming from the senses. And depending on the conditioning that are present within us, depending on the way the modes affect us, certain things zooms up within us. So you just go straight ahead. No need to change this. Okay, next one. Go behind and stop. So, the modes affect us in individually in particular ways, which cause certain windows to zoom up. Say alcoholic, as soon as they say alcohol, that way desire zooms up. And each of us has particular things that zoom up within us based on our conditioning. So this shapes how we perceive things. For us to keep a balance, we have to have perspective and purpose. But these are lost when unimportant things zoom up, then important things get zoomed out. So I discussed about how generally even the modes are lower, then the emotions, which are a non-rational response, are stronger. An emotion is meant to be balanced by reason, but quite often it is not. And that's how that leads us to act in an imbalanced way, which leads to unwanted reactions. And we talked about knowledge in the three modes. In ignorance, we perceive only material reality, and that too partially. Then in passion, we perceive only the material reality. In goodness, we see material and spiritual properly. So we discussed how there are three stages when we interact with the world. We perceive, we process, and then we pursue, we act on it. We decide to do something. So yesterday I talked about our perception primarily. Today I will talk about processing. Our theme was also the modes, how they affect our emotions, behaviors and relationships. So today I will first speak about relationships, and then tomorrow I will speak about behaviors and how to respond appropriately. How to see others' behaviors and how to respond with our behavior also. So let's look at it. Go behind. One slide before. Yeah. So interaction, when there is in different modes, there is a prominent theme when we interact. When people are in ignorance, or even one person is in ignorance, when there is an interaction, the basic mode is, if one is in ignorance, if this doesn't work out, if it doesn't work out for me, it should not work out for you also. So it's destruction. That if things don't work out right, I'll destroy. So most of us know stories like, say, there were two neighbors, and both of them were very envious of each other. So both of them were praying to God for help, for fulfilling their desires. And God came before them. I'm the first one. He said, "What do you want? I'll give it to you." He's eager to ask. He said, "Then, plus one caution. Whatever I give you, I'll give the double of that to your neighbor." And what did this person say? "Pluck out one maya. Make me blind in one eye. The neighbor will become blind in both eyes." Now, when this is told in some traditional setting, we just laugh at it. But it's not that remote from us. You know, I saw once advertisement once here in Mumbai itself. It says, "Buy this car and enjoy the envy in your neighbor's eyes. Enjoy the envy." So the idea is that this is the reference point is that if I don't get it, other person should not get it. Destruction. So when there's interaction, it means if my way doesn't work out, then let everything be destroyed. So in mode of passion, when there's interaction, we just want domination. Now my way has to work out. I am right and you have to accept that I am right. Now when we are talking about interaction, this can be between two individuals in a home, it can be in office, it can be between two groups, it can be between two countries, it can be interaction at various levels. But when the mode of passion is prominent, there has to be domination. Ishvaro aham aham bhogi, siddho aham balwan sukhi, adyo abhijanva nasmi, konyosi sadrusho maya. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 16th chapter, when Krishna talks about the Asuri Sampad, he says that the mentality of Ishvaro aham, I am the controller, bhogi, I am the enjoyer. Konyo asti sadrusho maya, who is there like me? No, adyo abhijanva nasmi, I am great and all around me are people who are telling me how great I am. So their greatness is that they tell me my greatness. So that is the kind of mentality that people have. And in this situation, in the mode of passion, it's as they often say, my way or the highway. So that's the way people interact. In the mode of goodness, when there's interaction, there's discussion. Okay, I have this understanding. No, okay, you are thinking this way. Why is it that way? Why are you thinking like that? Let me understand it. So, through this, a more mature understanding emerges. When we act in the mode of goodness, then we can discuss and we can resolve issues. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen most of the time. So another way of looking at it is, so you can go ahead. Yeah. So same way we could put it in a different word, that in the mode of ignorance, the destruction can be outward or it can be inward also. Say sometimes, one person thinks that I am in love with the other person, but the other person doesn't respond. And sometimes this one person wants to blame and destroy the other person. Or they become depressed and they try to destroy themselves. So the destruction can be outwards when we try to hurt the other person. Or the destruction can go inward also, where we think of ourselves as victims and we want to destroy ourselves. Either way, the destructive mentality is there. Now going further, if we see, there is the mode of passion in which one feels the same way, that I have to dominate, means I have to be the victor. So they see interactions only in terms of victory or defeat. They don't see interactions primarily as give and take. It is, I know and you have to accept what I know. Whereas in the mode of goodness, this part, yes, we are working together in this. In some cases I will be right, some cases you may be right. Going further, so if you see, now I talk about interactions, I will now talk about expectations. This is going to be the main theme of the class. So expectation means, I am talking both interaction and expectation, it's how we process things. What is the mindset we take with us when we are processing things? So in terms of expectation, when we are in the mode of ignorance, we always are fearful. This may go wrong, that may go wrong, that may go wrong. Everything will go wrong. Oh, the world is such a big bad place and I always get a raw deal in it. Yes, things do go wrong in life. But when we go in with that mentality, then that mentality becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, where we create more trouble than is necessary by our pessimistic mentality. So I said that for every problem there is a solution. But there are some people, with every solution they will find a problem. So in the mode of ignorance it is like that. In the mode of passion, whereas the mode of ignorance is excessively pessimistic, the mode of passion is unrealistically optimistic. Everything will go right. Oh, sorry, that's what I have written wrong over there. Sorry, everything will go right. So that's the mentality over there, where one just feels that, oh, I have made my plans and they should work out to perfection. On the other hand, in goodness, we understand that there are things which will go right. Let's focus on that and be happy with that. And things that go wrong, we'll see how to manage it. So we could say there's pessimism, optimism, and realism. Realism means there is a realistic assessment of situations. Now, it is good to have an optimistic mentality. But that doesn't mean that one, that optimistic mentality puts one in denial of reality. Optimism means we accept the present reality and then we see how we move forwards. Just like if there is a glass of water. Now, as we often say, you can say the glass is half empty or half full. Now, if I am looking at it half empty, you can say I am pessimistic. You can say if I am looking at it as a half full, I can say I am optimistic. But if I am very thirsty and the glass is half empty, then if I imagine that it is full, I will not do anything to fill it. Worse, if the glass is empty and I say, oh, it's full, that's not going to work. So optimism means not that we deny reality. We accept the reality and then we try to see how we can, if something is wrong with the reality, how we rectify it. You move ahead. So here I'll talk about some terminology which is developed in modern psychology, and then we'll see how that relates with the Vedic concept of the modes. So basically, this is that when people function in the world, broadly speaking, you can say there are two different kinds of people. Some people are maximizers and some people are optimizers. Maximizer means they want the absolute best in every single thing that they get. So for example, if somebody has to purchase a new mobile, then they'll want to look at every single mobile that is there in the market. And they will see which has the best feature, the best price, and which they can, then they will get that. I mean, I say, this is good, isn't it? We should always get the best deal. Yes, it's good to get the best deal. But suppose, in trying to get the best mobile, if a person, now there are so many mobiles and so many places from which you can get mobiles. If a person spends 6 months searching for a mobile itself, and that person forgets, oh, there are other things also we need to do in life. So, okay, we decide, I need to get a new mobile, and I want to get a good one. So, I'll decide that in the next 1 week, maybe I'll spend half an hour every day, 1 hour every day, whatever I want. I'll talk with a few people, ask around, and then I'll decide. So, we have to look for the best in our situation. If in everything we look for the absolute best, then in looking for the absolute best in everything, we can't do everything that we need to do. One thing takes a huge amount of time and other more important things get neglected. Suppose we are cooking because we have some party or some festival or some event at our home, and you want to cook very nicely. Now, it's good to cook very nicely. But suppose we take so much time to cook that the guests come and go. Then what is the use of cooking? Yes, maybe if we spend more time, we could cook even better. We could find out more of recipes. We could experiment more. We could do more. But then we live in the real world. So where we have a finite amount of time, and by that time we have to get things done. So in the situation that we are in, we have to do the best. So there is a psychologist, Barry Schwartz, who wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice. How more leads to less. So the whole idea is there that when people have too much choice, that doesn't give freedom, that causes burden. There's too much choice. So now in the Western world, in America and some other places, there is in every field, there is people are given a lot of choice. You decide. So even if you go to a doctor, because doctors are also afraid that we may get sued if something wrong happens. So in some extreme cases, what may even happen is if the disease is such that it's not so easy to diagnose. So the doctor may tell, okay, these are your symptoms. And in these symptoms, you may be having this disease or this disease or this disease. If you have this disease, you can take this treatment or this treatment. If you have this disease, you can take this treatment or this treatment. If you have this disease, you can take this treatment or this treatment. Now you decide which treatment you want. Now, how can a patient decide that? So, if the choice of the treatment is given to the patient, yes, if there's something major like should I do a surgery or should I not do a surgery, that choice the doctor can give with a recommendation. But if there is too much choice with respect to what the patient should do, the patient is not equipped to take that choice. So similarly, if I want to purchase a toothpaste and I go to supermarket, there are 100 brands of toothpaste. Now, if I decide to compare the ingredients of every single one of them, the price of every one of them, and then I decide to purchase, you know, probably the whole day will go off and I will not have brushed my tooth also. So, we cannot be unrealistic in terms of wanting the best in everything. We have to look for the best in our situation. So, optimization means it's maximum but in the situation. Not the absolute maximum or the absolute best. Now, if somebody is a maximizer, what is the result of that? So, sociologists have found that it has three consequences. Go ahead. So, first is that there is disappointment. Because when one puts in a lot of effort in getting something, then after they get it, there is so much expectation has been raised. Now, if I spend 6 months to decide which mobile to purchase, and then finally I purchase the mobile, it's a dream phone I have got now, and nothing lives up to our dream. So if there is a slight problem, there is a disappointment, there is an anticlimax. And even if one gets a very good product, there is always the nagging regret over there. Maybe if I had searched more, I might have got a better product. I might just have got a better product. And eventually what happens, that as products keep getting improved, a better product does come in the market. And then that leads to frustration. I'm stuck with this now. I should have got that one. So in this way, basically all that effort that is put in and trying to get the best, eventually it doesn't lead to greater satisfaction. So researchers have found that maximizers do get a better deal for their money as compared to optimizers. They are able to find a product which gives them more worth for their money. But it takes a price in something else. The price is in terms of the emotion that they invest in it and the negative emotion that results from it. The frustration, the disappointment, the regret, all that. So now this is with respect to products. That if we go in looking for the best in everything, then we will be frustrated. And this same mentality can be applied even to relationships. When we go out looking for the absolute best in everything, in relationship, if I want the absolute best, then the result is that no matter what we get or what we have, it leads to frustration. So, I was in America just a few months ago, and there was one boy who has been a devotee for almost 10-12 years, and he is very well educated from NIT and in a very big company in America. So, he has been trying to marry, but he has not been able to marry for almost 10 years now. So, then he was very frustrated by that. Then I was talking with his counselor over there. So, his counselor was telling, I said, why is he finding it so difficult? He said that, you know, he wants a girl who has the beauty of Miss Universe and who has the devotion of a Devahuti. So, nowadays, there is this, because in the past there was arranged marriages. Now, there is not, especially in the Western world, there is not so much the structure for arranged marriages. So, people want to find their own partner. And three things have happened in parallel. One is that the structure for forming relationships has disrupted for various reasons. Second is that because there is so much entertainment available in today's world, if you compare as compared to the past, it's much, much more. So there are so many movies, so many novels, and they all talk about romance. Most of the novels and movies are about romance. And then the whole idea is, you find your dream partner. So that, on one side, the structure has gone down. On one side, because of the media propaganda, the expectation has gone up. And thirdly, what has happened is that the pressure and the demand from the relationships has become too much. Because most people in today's world don't live in a joint family. They live in a nuclear family. So, traditionally, you know, if we have multiple relationships, different needs are fulfilled by different relationships. The relationship, the parent fulfills a particular need, the grandparent fulfills a particular need. With, say, a friend or a cousin, different needs are fulfilled. But when there are not many relationships around us, and there is only, say, the spouse, then all the needs from all the relationships we expect from the other person. It just doesn't work. So when we maximize with respect to relationships, we set ourselves up for frustration. So here, the problem is that we are having, now it's important to, when we move into any situation, we naturally have some expectations. And it is not that optimizers don't have expectations. But there's a difference between a realistic expectation and an unrealistic expectation. So those who are optimizers, they are in the, we could say, in the mode of goodness. Those are maximizers are in the mode of passion. And there is a natural emotion which is involved when there is either even when we are purchasing a product or when we are trying to form a relationship. But the problem is that when we are trying to form a relationship or we are trying to get anything, at that time the emotion has to be balanced by reason. I talked about this yesterday. Now, in the mode of passion, there is only the emotion. And there is the reason element has gone down inordinately. So, that reason is what helps us to come to realism. Not go towards optimism or go towards pessimism. So, when that reason element is there, then we can find out, we can balance our optimism and balance our pessimism with realism. Then we can move forwards. So, this applies not just to relationships, this also applies to groups. Now, if you want to join any group, any society, any social group, if you look for some ideal group of people, there is no ideal group existing in this world. And if at all there is an ideal group existing, we wouldn't gain admission there. Because we aren't ideal. We all have our issues. So, once I was giving a class and at that time I was talking about tolerance. I'll come to tolerance more in tomorrow's class when you talk about process, about pursuing. But it is tolerance is related to the moderating of expectations. So I was asking this. So in devotee, when we are practicing spiritual life also, we have to tolerate many things. So I asked, what all do we have to tolerate? So one devotee very enthusiastically raised hand. He said, yes, we have to tolerate devotees. We have to tolerate devotees. So I said, yes, this is a good realization. And that at least we should stay on in devotion. Even if there's some problem, we tolerate those problems. We tolerate devotees. But if we keep practicing, then as we come to the mode of goodness more and more, we will realize that devotees are tolerating us. So it works both ways. It is not just that we are tolerating others. We also have certain behavioral traits which trouble others. So, it's neither people around us ideal, nor are we ideal. So, this doesn't mean that we just accept anything and everything that the life dishes out to us. We have to take a stand at times. But we have to be realistic. I'm right now talking about processing. So, how to take a right stand, that I'll talk about tomorrow when we talk about pursuing. But, go ahead at this time of processing. So, I talk about this over-expectation. We have a situation where the whole world and the best in the whole world is depicted before us through the media. And when that becomes our reference point, then whatever we find in real life, that always seems pale and stale in comparison. So the reference point itself is such that when we see in the movies, when we see on TV, when we see in media, in general, we see the best of everything. But in real life, that's not how it is. Actually, even what we see in the media, in the people whom we see there, in real life, they're not as good looking or they're not whatever as good as they look out to be. But it's all depiction. So when this depiction is there, if that depiction in the media is the basis of our expectation, then that sets us up for frustration. Because our expectation is unrealistic. One of the biggest problems in today's world is when there is an overdose of entertainment. Entertainment has always been there throughout history. And you know, there may be different kinds of entertainments, music or drama or whatever, it has always been there. But the big difference between entertainment now and entertainment in the past is that the entertainment has become so dominant that for many people, the entertainment world is more real than the real world. That is where they live. That is what they think is the reality. In fact, if we consider who are the highest paid professionals in today's world, who do you think? Who are the highest paid professionals? Yes. Yes. Sports players, actors. You know, just now the IPL auction was there. And players, you know, like several crores. Some players who just knew they not even played international cricket, still they went for crores. So now, one social critic, he said that if a person can kick a ball with his foot, that person earns almost 50 times more than a person who can heal an injured foot. So, there was a movie about boxer, an Indian boxer from Northeast, Mary Kom. So, the movie was made in Bollywood, and the actress who made the movie, by making the movie, she earned more money than what this 4-star had earned throughout her life. So, entertainment is such that entertainment is paid enormously. Now, what a society values reflects the society's values. What a society values, values means if we are paying, now we may say, why are these entertainers, sports stars or movie stars being paid so much? It's outrageous amounts. That indicates that in society, there is such a great need for entertainment. Now, entertainment at one level is not like a basic need. We need food, we need water, we need air. We can live without entertainment. We can't live without food, air, water. But what has happened is in today's world, people feel entertainment is such a great need for them that they are ready to shell out enormous amounts of money for it. And why is there such a great need for entertainment? That is because there is a strong dissatisfaction with reality. It is such an unbearable dissatisfaction with reality that one has to escape into the entertainment world. And one is ready to pay any price to escape. Again, entertainment itself is not bad. And yes, life can become burdensome and we all need some break, we all need some stimulation. So some entertainment is fine. But when, again, one loses perspective and entertainment becomes such a compulsive need that one just can't function. There's one boy in Thailand or somewhere, in that part of, he was surfing on the net continuously for 71 hours. And he was just surfing, he forgot to eat, he forgot to sleep, he forgot to drink also. And finally, there itself, he got a stroke and fell unconscious. There was another boy in the neighbor, he just caught him, he just called the police and called the ambulance and he was saved. But surfing on the net, okay, you can read something, you can entertain yourself. But compulsiveness, where one even forgets basic bodily needs because of the urge to get that entertainment. So this is because we are so dissatisfied with the reality around us that we want to escape from it. And so the entertainment industry becomes the most paid industry because entertainment is an extremely highly felt need. There are needs which are actual needs, but there are also needs which are felt needs. So that is such a great felt need that people can't live without it. And when that entertainment world becomes our real world, becomes practically like our real world, then the result is that we lose our capacity to function in the real world. Our mind is so filled with images and ideas which we have got from the entertainment world that in the real world, whatever is available appears very unsatisfactory. So, can you move on? So, at one level, the solution is don't depress yourselves, depress your expectations of yourself and of others. So, if we somehow come to face, we have this conception of reality which we have gotten from the media, and then we compare that with the reality that we experience in life, and then it can be very depressing. Oh, this is so bad, that is so bad, this is so wrong, that is so wrong. And we can get frustrated by that. We can get depressed by that. Depression can be a clinical condition where medical treatment is required. But quite often, depression is usually it is not a clinical condition. It is basically when life gives us a raw deal and we are unable to accept it. When what we have aspired for, what we have dreamt for, we just don't get it and we are unable to accept it. So then we get depressed. Now, small children, when they don't get what they want, they start crying loudly. And crying and maybe screaming and throwing a temper tantrum. Older people may not have the facility to cry, but they go into depression. So basically, a basic lesson of growing up, a basic point about growing up is learning to take no gracefully. A child, I want this toy, and no, child starts crying. But then as we grow up, we understand that everything that we want, we may not get it. This again doesn't mean that we should not aspire for anything. It's just that we have to be realistic. So many people are physically grown up, but emotionally they're still like children. So one indication that one is still emotionally in a childhood is that one is not able to take no gracefully. It's painful if we have put in a lot of effort to get something and we don't get it. But then it happens with everyone. Yes, we take it on our chest and move on with life. Yes, we have to accept that's how life is. If you look at scriptures, even for great saintly devotees, life was not a cakewalk. Ram, for no fault of his, was exiled. The Pandavas, for no fault of theirs, were persecuted. So, the scriptures also tell us that life is not a cakewalk for whoever they may be. So this, we don't have to become depressed. So this depression can be in two ways. When it goes inward, in more. So in the mode of passion, there is too much expectation. And when there is that expectation does not work out, then one goes into depression. Oh, nothing will work out. So either one becomes too pessimistic about others, or we become too pessimistic about ourselves. So either way, this becomes very emotionally destructive for ourselves or for others. So now the word depress has a negative connotation. Here I am not using the negative connotation. Basically lower, moderate the expectations. Basically come from being a maximizer to a optimizer. Can you move on? So now this brings us to another point, that we all move forward, we are driven in life by ambition. And spiritual life, often we are told, you should be satisfied. But in many, especially people who live in today's competitive world, often satisfaction is considered a negative thing. Now, if you are satisfied, what drive you will have? Now, how will you achieve in your life? How will you move forward? They say, never be satisfied. That's how you will be able to move on in your life. So, how can should we have ambition? And if we have ambition, then can we never have satisfaction? What does it mean? So does it mean that if I have to be satisfied, I have to give up ambition? No, not exactly. There is, when we can have satisfaction and we can have also ambition. The balance comes based on what is the reference point. If my ambition is about what I will get, then what I am going to get in the world is not in my control. If my ambition is about what I am going to give, what I am going to contribute, then that is in my control. If I start with, okay, I'm going to come first in my class. Let's, if I'm a student, I want to come first in my class, that's good. That'll inspire me to study seriously. But if I somehow don't come first in the class, then I'll just go into depression. So if my focus is on, okay, I will do my very best. If the ambition is not so much in terms of expectation as in terms of contribution. Yes, I have certain abilities, and if I discipline myself, if I train myself, if I work hard, I can hone these abilities. And with this, I can make a better contribution. So the ambition can be in terms of what we are bringing in. Now, of course, there is a natural expectation of reciprocation, and I'll come to that in a few minutes. But the point is that if the ambition is about what we will get, we put ourselves in insecurity. Because what we are going to get is not in our control. You know, that our effort is in our control, but the result is not in our control. So if the ambition, can be about what we are going to contribute, how we are going to put in the effort. And satisfaction means that we may look at what we don't have, but we focus on what we have. We focus on what we have. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 17th chapter, in the 16th verse, Krishna says, satisfaction is an austerity of the mind. Manah prasada saumyatvam maunam atma vinigraha bhava samshuddhityetat tapomanasamuchyate. Krishna says, tapomanasamuchyate. This is an austerity of the mind. The first austerity is manah prasada, satisfaction. So normally, we think of satisfaction as an emotion that we feel. Oh, I'm feeling satisfied. I'm not feeling satisfied. So, yes, satisfaction is a feeling. Satisfaction is an emotion. But satisfaction is not just an emotion. Satisfaction can also be a decision. That means, if I choose to look at what I have, oh, this is right in my life, this is good in my life, this is good in my life, then I can be satisfied. If I look at all that I don't have, I'll be dissatisfied. So when we say satisfaction is a decision, that means that we make consciously the effort to focus on what is right in our life. One of the easiest ways to change our mind from negative, grudging, irritated to positive is to look for what is right in our life, to count our blessings. When we feel agitated, hey, you know, this person did like this, that person did like this, that went wrong. Okay, count down. Okay, you know, what is right in my life? I say, nothing is right, the mind may scream. Oh, really? Well, at least I'm alive, I'm healthy, I'm not starving. There are so many people, so much worse is happening in our life, in their life as compared to what is in our life. So, if we look at the movies, we will see there are so many things which are better. You know, this person looks so good, this person has this much money, this person is having this. If we look at the news, you see, there is so much wrong in the world also. So, basically, if we can just focus on what is right, that can give us some satisfaction. This is not that more things can't be right, but there are things which are right. So, that is the basis of satisfaction as a decision means we consciously direct our vision from what is wrong to what is right, from what we don't have to what we have. So when we do this, we can have satisfaction. Now this doesn't mean, when I'm looking at what I have, that doesn't mean I don't try for something more. But when trying for something more, I focus on contribution, not on expectation. Okay, this many things are right in my life, and I would like this also to be right. To set that right, what can I do? So that way, we can have a positive focus of the mind. Can you go ahead? So now, the Bhagavad Gita 2.47 is one of the most common and one of the most mysterious verses from the Bhagavad Gita. Karmanyevadhikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana ma karma phala heturbhur ma te sangosto karmani. I was in a university in America, and there was an Indian student. She was asking, if I start living according, she was saying that, you are teaching Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita is not practical at all. I said, what do you mean? She said that, if I am a student, now if, what inspires me to study is a thought that, I will get good grades, I will get into a great university, I will get a good job, that is what inspires me to work. If I become detached from that, how will I ever work? So, the detachment is not practical, because it is our attachment that inspires us to perform. So how is this practical? So I explained that her conception of what the Bhagavad Gita teaches is wrong. The Bhagavad Gita asks us to be detached from results, not from goals. Karmanyevadhikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana. Phala is result. Now results are what we get after an action is done. Goals are what we set before the action is done. We cannot understand a book ever without understanding its context. So if I take the Bhagavad Gita, then I have to look at the Mahabharata. After the Bhagavad Gita was spoken, Arjuna fought the Mahabharata war. And when he fought that Mahabharata war, at that time, every morning, he would come out with a strategy. This is the enemy I'm going to tackle today. These are the forces that I'm going to attack. And that was basically a goal which he was setting for each day. And Krishna, as his charioteer, helped him to go about achieving the goals. So it's not that Arjuna was uncaring when he was working. And before that, when Arjuna as a student was practicing archery, he wanted to be the best archer. And it was that goal that motivated him to work hard. So Arjuna is not being told that be detached from goals. So set goals. Now what is the big difference? You may say, okay, it's the same thing, isn't it? But the difference is that what is in our control and what is not in our control. When we set goals, that is the time when we can make our contribution. So the contribution is in our hands. As a student, if I'm studying for my exam, then the contribution is in my hand. How well do I study? How well do I prepare myself? That is in my hand. Now, after I have given the exams, then the results are not in my hands. So that is what I need to be detached from. Understanding that now I have done my part, that there are factors beyond my control which also shape the results. So can you go ahead? Some of you might have been there last year when I took a seminar on destiny. So there I spoke elaborately about this. I'll just talk about this in an introductory way here. That the relationship between action and result is not simply point A to point B. It's not that this action produces this result. It's a long journey that goes through it. There is karma, that is the action that we do, and phala is the result that we want. But the karma alone doesn't produce the phala. In between, there is daiva and kala. Daiva is destiny and kala is time. So karma has to be done, the action has to be done, but after that, the destiny has to be right and the time has to pass rightly enough. Then only the result will come. So, consider for example farming. when a farmer sows the seeds and plows the land. That is the karma. After that, the rain coming in time, in proper quantity, is the daima. And after that, the season changing till the harvest comes. That is the kala. So karma plus daiva plus kala leads to phala. Well, you say when a couple get married, they want to have a child. And they can try to have a child. But just their effort is not enough. There has to be daiva. There is something beyond. Even with the best doctor's help, it's not that it's automatically guaranteed. There is something beyond us which is also controlled. That is daiva. And then even if that sanction, it's not that tomorrow one can get a baby. There's a whole period of gestation, 9-10 months, and then after that after that kala is passed, then there is phala, then the child is born. So in some cases, the role of daiva and kala is easy to see. In some cases, it may not be very easy to see. So suppose we are preparing for an exam. So our part is the karma. But then, by destiny, between our doing karma and getting the phala, many things may come up. We might not be able to prepare, so we might just forget some things at that time. Or maybe there are too many good competitors at that time. Or maybe the examiner is in a bad mood. Or maybe if there's a machine instead of an examiner, the machine malfunctions. Something goes wrong in the computer code. So the daiva may not work out right. So the destiny also plays a role. Now the destiny is not something arbitrary and cruel out there. Destiny is also basically the sum total of our own past karma. So what we have done in the past, that good actions and bad actions, they get accumulated as destiny. So, and they come upon us at different times. So that's why two people may do the same karma, but they may not get the same phala. Two students may study together, but one student gets very high marks, the other student doesn't get that many good marks. So daiva is different. And sometimes the kala also plays a role. That means for some people, at that time just may not be right. And even if they do their best, it just doesn't work at that time. So have to accept this. So when the Bhagavad Gita says be satisfied or be detached, the detachment is not from karma, the detachment is from phala. That's why we look at the full verse. Ma phaleshu kadachana. You do not have a right to the fruit, do not be attached to the result. That's what Krishna is saying. But the other part is karmanne vadhikaraste. You have a right to do your work, and not only do you have a right to do your work, the last line is ma te sangostu akarmani. Do not be attached to not doing your work. That means Krishna is saying, it is your responsibility to do your work well. So put in your effort to the best that you can. You have a right to do that and you have a responsibility to do that. So the karma is both our right and our responsibility. So, and then the third line is, Ma karma phala heturbhur. Do not think that you alone are the cause of the result. So when we understand this, then we can look at expectation in a more informed way. Whenever we go into any situation, we take a new job, we form a new relationship, we go to a new place, there's a natural expectation that is there. Oh, there's some apprehension, but some expectations also there. So there are emotions that are involved over there. But the emotions need to be balanced, emotion needs to be balanced by reason. When this balance is there, then we can accept reality. And then only when we accept reality, then we can decide, okay, how can I improve reality? It's not that we can't improve reality, but we have to begin with accepting the reality. You go ahead. Yeah. So now we move to the spiritual side, which will come back again tomorrow in more detail. We can be optimizers in our material life. Optimizers with the products that we purchase, the relationship that we pursue. But we need to maximize our spiritual. You know, go for the best. In the spiritual realm also, there are many different options. Maybe I can do this, maybe I can do that, maybe I can do that. The Bhagavad Gita reveals a conception of God who is all attractive. Krishna is Sarva Akarshati Iti Krishna, one who attracts everyone. Yad yad vibhuti matsattvam shrimadurjitam evava tattadevavagachattvam mamatejo amsha sambhava. Krishna says that whatever is attractive in this world, all that is present in me. It is reflecting a spark of my splendor. So, whatever we find attractive in the world around us, it is reflecting a spark of Krishna's splendor. I have written a book on reincarnation. So, based on that, I have traveled in various parts of the world and given classes on reincarnation. So, at one time, one person asked me a question. This was that, you know, I'm in love with a girl. Both of us want to marry each other, but somehow our families are not consenting. And it's not working out. So, what karma can I do by which I can marry her in my next life? So, the whole concept of reincarnation has been very romanticized by Bollywood. So, many times there are some movies in which say the hero and heroine are not able to unite, and then both of them die, and then next life both of them are born with the same looks, with exactly the same body, and then they continue that romance in the next life. So basically, reincarnation is just treated like a plot twist in a drama story, in a romance story. So because of that, people have that expectation that, okay, so the relationship you are having this lifetime, I'll continue in my next lifetime. So, actually when the soul reincarnates from one body to another, the soul has lived in a particular way in this lifetime, and based on that, the soul is going to get a different body in the next lifetime. So, what kind of body that is going to get, where that soul is going to go, all that is quite unpredictable for us from this perspective. But the point, so when I answered this question, I said that actually we have two kinds of relationships. We have a vertical relationship with Krishna, with God, who is all attractive, and we have horizontal relationship with others. So now, then we, when we have this vertical and horizontal relationships, we are souls who are on a multi-life journey of spiritual evolution. And spiritual evolution essentially means we evolve in our wisdom and in our devotion. We evolve in our understanding of what is actually real. We become wiser. And that wisdom leads to evolution in our object of love. So we do have affection for the people around us, for the things in this world. But we understand that my affection is ultimately meant for Krishna. So that relationship with Krishna is our eternal relationship. And developing that is life's primary purpose. So of course, we can't survive only on that relationship. We are social beings. So we need relationships in the world also. However, the nature of this world is that some relationships may work out, some relationships may not work out. That's just like with everything else in life. We achieve, set certain goals for ourselves. Some goals we are able to achieve. Some goals we are not able to achieve. So, if we wanted a particular relationship but it didn't work out, then rather than trying to replicate that relationship in a future life, we can understand that whatever was attractive in that relationship, that attractiveness actually came from Krishna. So, by Krishna's arrangement, it's not that the attractiveness of that person is false.
Yes, there can be an attractiveness. Different people have different qualities, and sometimes we may be attracted to someone. Sometimes the attraction may be just superficial, but sometimes there can be a deep-rooted attraction also. But still, those attributes of that person are not just their attributes. Yes, they are their attributes, but it's also Krishna who is giving those attributes to them. So Krishna is giving them a spark of his splendor. So that's how those people are able to attract us so much. So if sometimes some relationship with someone in this world doesn't work out, then we have to see that, okay, whatever I found attractive in this person, that and more is present in Krishna. So if this doesn't work out, let me focus on that. That doesn't mean we just don't care for this relationship. I'm going to talk about pursuing in tomorrow's class. But the point here is, while processing, we just don't lament and go into, as they say, a pity party. Just feeling sorry for ourselves. Oh, this didn't work out, that didn't work out, that didn't work out. Just feel sorry for yourself. So, rather than that, okay, we move on with life and focus on our vertical relationship. So, now we all try to develop relationships. Krishna is all attractive. He is all loving. And he is always available for us. He is there in our hearts. Sarvasya chaham hridisan nivishto. He is there in our hearts right now. And he is always there. Krishna is... Do you know how far away Krishna is from us? How far is he? Sorry? Super soul. So how far is he? Very near to us, yes. But how near? Inside us, that's true. What did you say? Okay, as close as the eyelids? Okay, yes, that's true. One way to understand it, Krishna is just one thought away from us. He's just one thought away from us. If we think about him, we are connected with him. We may not perceive that connection, we may not relish that connection right now. But Krishna is just one thought away from us. So, if we direct our thoughts towards him, he is present and he will make his presence manifest to us as we become more and more receptive and more pure. But he is there always. So, he's always available. And he loves us already. It is not that because we are very sinful, we have been godless, we have been living materialistically, we might have done some sinful things. That doesn't mean Krishna stops loving us. Krishna's love for us is not based on who we are. It is based on who he is. He is Surudam Sarvabhutana. Sometimes we say Krishna is Bhaktavatsala. He is the lover of his devotees. That's true. But he is not the lover only of his devotees. He is also, Lal Maharaj says, Krupana Vatsala. Even people who are materialistic, he loves them also. He is Surudam Sarvabhutana. He is the well-wisher of all living beings. So that relationship with Krishna is always available for us. So in many relationships, we want to form a relationship but other person is not interested. Or we are putting a lot into the relationship but other person is not reciprocating. In the case of Krishna, he is there for us. Just so he is available for us. We just have to connect with him. Go ahead. So now, we, sometimes when we talk about, surrender to Krishna, that might seem like, I just surrender to Krishna, then I become powerless, I just chant and I don't do anything else. No, actually, independence to Krishna is independence. When we become dependent on Krishna, then that gives us independence from the ups and downs of the world. That vertical connection with Krishna is what stabilizes us. It strengthens us. So when things go wrong in this world, we will be shaken. But if we are surrendered to Krishna, if we are dependent on Krishna, then in that dependence on Krishna, we get strength. Yes, this has got wrong. Big things wrong may be there in our life. But we understand that bigger than whatever has gone wrong is Krishna. And he is there. He is waiting. He is available for me. So actually, the more the devotee becomes dependent on Krishna, in terms of devotionally taking shelter of Krishna, in terms of connecting with him, one becomes independent. And independent doesn't mean uncaring. Independent means that one is having internal stability. There can be dependence, independence, and interdependence. So, the best relationships are not the relationship of dependence, but the relationships of interdependence. So, but only independent people can become interdependent. So, each of us, by our practice of bhakti, by connecting with Krishna through the process of bhakti, we can become independent. And then, when we form a relationship, that won't make us dependent on the other person. We will be an independent individual who is secure in our relationship with Krishna, and then we pursue another relationship where there is interdependence. So that interdependence is what is fulfilling. Dependence is often crippling. When there is dependence in the relationship, that other person gets upset. We feel as if it is the end of the world for me. So, if the other person is happy, then we feel happy. Yes, the natural reciprocation. But when there is dependence, it can be crippling. But when there is interdependence, then that is uplifting. Sometimes I am down, the other person lifts me up, and the other person is down, I lift them up. So we it is not that by our devotion we become uncaring in our other relationships. Rather, we are able to bring more maturity into that relationship. So when we talk about processing what happens in the world, if in our heart, if in our consciousness there is Krishna, if we are connected with Krishna, then that connection with Krishna gives us internal stability. And then with maturity we can process what is happening. Somebody deals unfairly with us. Something goes wrong in our life. Okay, how do I deal with it? Krishna, I take shelter of you. Will you please guide me? So earlier I said that we count our blessings, we look for what is right. If we have practiced bhakti and connect with Krishna, then no matter what goes wrong in our life, we'll find this one thing is right. I can still chant Krishna's names and Krishna is there with me. I can still worship Krishna. I can still study his message. I can hear about it and I get shelter in that. So when that one relationship is stable, then that is something which you can count on. That becomes our blessing, our strength, by which we can face what is happening externally. So for a devotee, it is the processing internally that is significantly different. In fact, it's drastically different. So the events happen to everyone. So we see in the Bhagavatam, we see Parikshit Maharaj was cursed unfairly. For a minor infraction, he was cursed to die. So that event happened externally, but internally he processed it in a way. How did he process it? He said, okay, this is Krishna who is coming in the form of this curse to detach me. To detach me. And then he chose to become detached. He focused on just wholeheartedly hearing the Bhagavatam. But this was not the only way in which he always acted. If we see, when he was a king, at that time, when the cow and the bull, they were being attacked. When Parikshit Maharaj was a king, at that time he was surveying his kingdom, and he came to a place where he saw there was a cow and a bull, and the bull was being attacked by a man who was looking like a king, dressed in black, and his bull was being tormented by this king. And he was furious and took out his sword to punish this person. But before that, he turned towards the bull and asked him, "What is the cause of your suffering?" Now, at one level, he says, "Absurd, can't you see? This man is beating me, that is the cause of my suffering." It may seem to be a silly question. You can even say it's an insensitive question. What is the cause of my suffering? This person is beating me. But Parikshit Maharaj still asked that question. And the bull's answer is also very intriguing. He says, actually, the cause of suffering is very difficult to determine. Some people say it is because of one's past karma. Some people say it's just the nature of this world.
Some people say that it is just kala. Sometimes we go through unfavorable time. Some people say that it is just unknowable. So he says, I can't know what is the cause of myself. And you know, we say, well, he is causing you suffering. Why don't you tell that? But he just does that. And what does Parikshit say? Parikshit says, bravo. He says, your words show that you are very learned. Your words show that you are actually Dharma. You are Dharma personified, who has come as this bull. And he lords him. Now he still takes the disciplinary action. He punishes the Kali, who is masquerading as a king and doing atrocious activities. But the point of this discussion is that both of them are looking for causes beyond the immediate. There is an immediate cause, and that has to be dealt with appropriately. But there are causes beyond the immediate also. And they're focusing on that. So, sometimes when we look at a particular situation in our life, we find that, why is this person doing like this? Why is this happening? Sometimes, you know, we may attribute, this person is the cause of my suffering. This situation is the cause of my suffering. But there are causes beyond the immediate also. So, rather than focusing and obsessing on that person, we process with that. Ultimately, the why question will lead me only to frustration. So, let me simply focus, how can I move ahead right now? How can I move ahead right now? Instead of the why question, I ask the how question. Okay, I can't know why this is happening, but how can I best move forward? So that, how I can move forward, what to do in that, we will discuss in tomorrow's class. I'll summarize what I spoke today. So, I spoke primarily about how the modes affect our relationships, our interactions with others. So, we are talking about how the modes shape how we perceive things, how we process things, and how we pursue. So, today we discuss about how we process. So, in processing, whatever happens to us, we have a particular frame of mind which we bring to the table. So, we discussed in the mode of passion, in the mode of ignorance, and mode of goodness. While interaction, what are the mindsets? The three D's. Does anyone remember? Destruction is in ignorance, in passion, domination, in goodness, discussion. Yes. And then discussed about the mentality that we have. That is the victim mentality, the victor mentality, and the partner mentality. Let's work together. So with respect to expectations, in ignorance, we think that everything will go wrong. In passion, everything will go right. In goodness, let's focus on what is right and let's deal with what is wrong. So there is pessimism, excessive pessimism, excessive optimism, and realism. There is goodness. So when we talked about drawing in from modern psychology, when people have too much expectation, they are called a maximizer. So that maximizing mentality corresponds to the mode of passion. And optimizing mentality. Maximizing means I want the absolute best. Optimization means I want the best in the situation. I discuss examples of purchasing a mobile, purchasing a toothpaste, or cooking for an occasion. In all these, if we go for the absolute best without considering other factors, we get into trouble. So maximizers, they get a better deal for their money when they buy a product, but there is disappointment because the product doesn't live up to the expectation. There is the lingering fear that there might be a better product which I would have got if I had just searched more, and eventually there's frustration because the better product does come out. So when we get that, bring that same maximizing mentality into our relationships, then we are looking for the absolute best. And that creates an unrealistic expectation. The reason why there is so much problem in the relationships nowadays is threefold. One is the structure for forming relationships has gone down. It is not there so easily accessible for most people. Second is that the because of the propaganda from the media, from the movies, from the novels, the expectation of the relationships is too high. And thirdly, because we don't have a joint family structure, so we have multiple needs which we expect to be fulfilled from the same relationship, and all that creates excessive expectation and then frustration. So we need to be optimizers. If we want everything to be ideal, first of all, we ourselves are not ideal. So don't depress yourself, depress your expectations of others and of ourselves. So depressing our expectations of ourselves means choosing satisfaction. So satisfaction means we focus on what is right, on what is good in our life. That is our austerity of the mind. And by consciously counting our blessings, we can bring positive emotions within us. And we can still have ambition also, because if we focus ambition on contribution, not on expectation. Not my ambition, not that I will get the best result, but I will do my best. So we discussed karmanyevadhikarasya in the Gita is not telling us to become apathetic. It is be detached from results, not from goals. So we set the goals so that we can make the best contribution. But we understand the results are not in our control, so we focus on what is in our hands. Then I discussed about the role of destiny. Karma, does anyone remember that equation? Karma plus daiva plus kala leads to phala. So, karma is in our hands. Daiva is not something arbitrary. It is the sum total of our own karma, which of our past karma, which comes upon us in different ways, and time. That's what leads to phala. I give two examples. One is of farming and other of procreation. So when we try to form a relationship, there also daiva and kala, how they come into the picture, we don't know. So we focus on karma. Here the karma is in our hands. Krishna is saying do the karma the best. Karma is our right and our responsibility. And with respect to relationships, what is the action that we can do? I talked about we maximize vertically. We focus from our side on developing our vertical relationship with Krishna. By we understand that Krishna is all attractive, that whatever attractiveness we may find in someone, that and much more is present in Krishna. So rather than trying to somehow or the other, like this boy saying that how can I marry my dream girl in my next life, we're trying to extend this relationship in the next life, we focus on okay, whatever is attractive here, that is there in Krishna. So Krishna is all attractive, is all loving, he's all available, he's just one thought away from us. And his love for us is based on who he is, not who we are. So through, if we focus on developing our relationship with Krishna, independence to Krishna is independence. We get inner strength, inner stability. And by that, we can become more mature in our horizontal relationship with others. We can make a better contribution in those relationships. And thus, the independence can help us to become interdependent. Otherwise, when we are dependent on someone else, that is crippling. Interdependence is uplifting. And I concluded by talking about how when there are problems in relationships, the Bhagavatam looks for causes beyond the immediate. When we process the issue, we just don't just obsess on this person is acting in this way, that is the problem. See, there's many other factors going on. So rather than obsessing on why this person is doing like this, we focus on how, and we focus on how I can do my best in the situation, how I can move forward in that situation. And that can give a positive energy for our consciousness. So how to work on that, how, we'll discuss in tomorrow's class. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, please.
When we think of achieving a goal, the first thing which comes is the end result. Okay, for example, when this temple was built, there was a goal in somebody's mind, and then the action started. And then and in midway, we do the actions, and then we reach the end result. So my question here, when we said that we attach to the goal but not to the result, there's a confusion that sometimes the goal is the end result, the image of the end result, which is the starting point. So that itself drives the performance many a times when things don't go well. So it's actually the same, no? It's the goal is the end result, which is at the starting point.
Okay.
So how do we not get attached to it?
Okay, good question. So in a sense, the goal that we dream about is the result that we want to get. So how can we, if, since the goal and result are the same thing, how can we be attached to the goal and detached from the result? Yeah, it is, see the word attachment and detachment, for all of us, they invoke certain emotions within us. Sometimes if you are spiritual, you will say, hey, attachment is very bad. If we are materialistic, we will say detachment is very bad. We will become irresponsible. So, let's not get caught too much in words. Let's understand the concept basically. In every situation in our life, there is something in our control and something not in our control. And we can only focus on and improve that which is in our control. And that which is not in our control, we just have to leave it. How it will work out, we don't know. If we are materialistic, then we think that it's just by chance what will happen out there. If we are spiritual, we understand there is some higher plan. What is not in my control is ultimately in God's control. So He will bring out some good out of it. But the point is that there is something in our control and there is something out of our control. And when you are saying be attached to the goal, that means focus on what is in your control. Be detached from the result means stop worrying about that which is not in your control. So I'll give two examples. Suppose a student is preparing for some exams and say there are 5 papers. Student has studied very well for one paper and gives the paper. But then the student, after doing the paper, did I do this sum right? Did I write this answer well? Could I have written this better? Well, if the student gets too caught in that, and next week there is another paper. To focus on that. We can't let ourselves be caught in the past. Okay, even if I made a silly mistake in this one. Yeah, what a stupid thing, you know. Why did I make that silly mistake? Okay, I made a mistake. Now move on. That is no longer in my control. But tomorrow is a new exam. That is still in my control. Let me focus on that. So when you're saying, say, we focus on the goal, that means that, okay, you want to achieve this goal and this is the process I want to follow to get that goal, and I'll follow this process as well as I can. But now, when that exam is over, my part, I have done it. Now, whether I did it well, I could have done it better, that's over now, that chapter is over. Just move on. Now a new chapter has begun, let me focus on that. So after that exam has been given, what result I am going to get is not in my control. So let go of the things that are not in our control. That is what detachment means. Detachment from results means. Similarly, with respect to interactions, if we talk about relationships, now if there is some conflict between two people, and then you want to address the conflict. So now, how we conduct ourselves during the confrontation. Sometimes if there are some festering issues, we may have to confront the other person. And we have to discuss the issues. We can't just keep that wound be festering. So then when we discuss that issue. So at that time, how we behave, you know, how we present our case, how we present our concerns, whether we approach in a very judgmental, accusatory way, or we try to approach in a objective, reasonable way, that's up to us. Now, how the other person is going to respond is not in our control. So, be attached to the goal means, if I go into the conflict resolution only thinking, this person is never going to understand. This person is just like this and this person is never going to improve, nothing is going to improve. This is just a waste of time. Then even going into that confrontation is a waste of time only. If I go totally with a pessimistic attitude, then that will come out in my demeanor itself. I will speak in a negative way. I will cast aspersions on the other person while I'm speaking. And I'll doom any possibility of resolution. So when I'm going in, I can go in with the goal that I want this issue to be amicably resolved. So I'll express my concerns and the other person has some, so I'll try to hear them.
So I can focus on how I can bring my best to the table of discussion. So that is the focus on what is in my control. But sometimes, despite our doing that, the other person just reacts in an unreasonable way and things just don't work out. Okay, then we did our part, move on now. So that means, rather than looking at the world of detachment and attachment, we can say focus on the goal, don't focus on the result. Because focusing on the goal helps us to bring out our best. Focusing on the result simply makes us feel insecure because the result is not in our control. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Just one more quick one. When you say learning to take no gracefully, in the corporate world, no is not expected to come out from people where you have to work. So we often find people saying no when there is something to do. So again, there is a, like, on one hand, we are saying learning to take no gracefully, whereas in the corporate context, no is not supposed to.
I saying no means an employee should not say no to a job given by the employer, or what is saying no means
so
what?
There is a tendency for people to just say no for more work coming their way. Okay, so now you are at the time when you are passing on work to somebody. Okay, and here we say, no is not easy to take in that situation.
Okay.
So how do we?
Yeah, okay. So I said a part of growing up is learning to take no gracefully. But then I also said that, but then it's also in the corporate world, you know, people tend to want to run away from work. So if we delegate some work to them and they just keep saying no, then we will be burdened with all the work. So what do we do? Is that that time also we have to accept the no? No, I'm not talking about that kind of situation. What I was talking about is, by factors beyond our control, sometimes just things go wrong. So, and so I was giving a presentation in a big multinational company in America, and I had got a very good PowerPoint. And this was one of the biggest companies in the world, and there they projected it work. It's a big technology company, but they projected it work. So then, now what can I do at that time? I was talking about stress management, but I was stressed by that. That is one theme I was talking about. But then that's not in my control. I accept that and I move on. So, now I would say that whoever is the organizer of that program or the person in the company, they have to do a debriefing session. You know, why did this not work? And they have to take the appropriate people to task and they have to deal with it at that, in the appropriate way. But at that time, okay, I had to give the talk without a presentation. So, learning to take no gracefully means when things are beyond our control, we accept that that thing is beyond our control and just move on with what is in our control. So, in the corporate world, if somebody is meant to share the workload and is not taking that, then they are shirking from the responsibility, and then appropriate action may need to be taken. You know, we may inform some higher authorities, or we may give some negative remark about them if we are in the authority position or whatever. So we're not when saying no gracefully, taking no gracefully doesn't mean we let people take us on a ride. It simply means when things are not in our control, we don't obsess so much over that wrong thing that has happened that we can't move on. Okay? Thank you.
Hare Krishna Guruji.
Yes. Who is it? Okay, yeah.
I had a similar question to what he was asking right from the corporate world only. I mean, generally the focus in the corporate world is on the goal itself.
Yeah.
And whatever you know, efforts you would have put in is behind the curtain. And at the end of it, you know, you're asked a question, why this has not been achieved sometimes. And in that case, how do we kind of cut a balance between the two? I mean, yeah. They expect only the result.
That's true.
The efforts are not looked at.
Yeah. So in the corporate world, people don't look at the efforts. They just want the results. Now that is the difference between Krishna and the world. The world looks outside in, Krishna looks inside out. World looks outside in means, first they look at our appearance, they look at the results. And then, if they find that is good, then they, okay, how did you achieve so much results? Then they look at the efforts. If you don't achieve the results, then probably you didn't work only. You must have been lazy or whatever. So Krishna looks inside out. We know the story of when the Vanaras were building a bridge. At that time, there was a small squirrel. He also contributed. The monkeys felt, you know what, the squirrel is coming in our way. But Lord Ram said, no, she is doing her best, you are doing your best. I am satisfied with both of them. So, that's why we all need, for our own self-understanding and for our own self-worth, a connection with Krishna. The world may not appreciate our efforts, but if we are putting in good efforts, we know that Krishna is noticing that. And that gives us some stability, some security. Having said that, we live in a competitive world. So we do need to look for results also. So again, in our work also, we may need to become optimizers. That means, say, students, for example. Some students may just decide, okay, I love this subject and I want to study this subject very well. That's a good attitude. But if you have a finite time in which you have to study the subject, then the students have to balance between getting a proper understanding of the subject and studying in a way by which they get the marks. Sometimes you may study so much this subject from this book, that book, that book. We get a very good understanding, but we don't study in a way that we get the marks. Now, of course, some students may go to the other extreme and just look at the previous year's papers and study only what kind of questions are going to come, and they try to get the marks. Then that may also not be very good. But the point is that if we live in a particular world, particular situation, we have to optimize to that situation. So we also need to think, okay, I'm putting in so much effort, but how can I put the effort by which the result will also come? So we see even in spiritual circles that is there. Srila Prabhupada, his spiritual master Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur told that we should preach about Krishna even if no one comes. He says, just preach to the walls. Now, in principle, this is about indomitable spirit about sharing, or spirit of sharing about Krishna. Now, when Srila Prabhupada was speaking about Krishna in India, he did not get much response. Now, he could have said, I am following my spiritual master's instruction. Nobody is coming, I will preach to the walls. But he did not do that. He, in his old age, decided to go to America. Because he felt people there will be more receptive. And if they become spiritual, then Indians will also become spiritual. So he was, in principle, he was indefatigable. I'm going to serve Krishna, I'm going to glorify Krishna, that I'm going to do. But in practice, he was intelligent. You know, where will I get the best results? And he invested his energy there. So similarly, if we are finding we are putting in efforts and not getting the results, then we may have to maybe discuss with some others who are more expert. You know, what can I do? Maybe we are not following the right strategy, or we're not putting in the effort in the right direction. So that is basically, we have to learn to optimize our efforts. So that in the real situation, the results that are the, in terms of the parameters that are expected, the results in those efforts will also come. And in spite of that, if they don't come, then we have to understand that it is daiva. But sometimes because of destiny, we do get bad efforts. We do get a bad name or we get bad results. Now, if we are honest, we will also see that sometimes, you know, we just put in a little effort and big results come out. So if you are in marketing, sometimes we just go to so many people and nobody seems to take the product. And sometimes we just go to one person and we get a big deal. And then there we are putting very little effort, but we got a big result over there. So destiny, if you see in the long run, it balances out. Sometimes with a lot of effort also not much result comes. Sometimes with a little effort also, a good significant, the big result also comes. So we accept that sometimes it doesn't work out. We see that as destiny. Okay? Thank you. Yes,
first of all, thank you very much for such an enlightening, relishable and very brilliant talk.
Okay.
It brings up several questions to me, but some are structural in nature, technical, so I would leave that. I would request you to answer at least two functional, fundamental questions. First is, you said that in maximizer versus optimizer, the maximizer is not generally focusing on the time, he's focusing on the perfectionism.
Correct.
So, but you said that materially we should be optimizers, spiritually we should be maximizers. My intelligence sounds to disagree this, because I found myself that at times in spiritual life also I feel like, okay, if I can't be pure devotee, if I can't do the things perfectly, let me not do that. So isn't it a kind of a wrong maximizing mentality and not optimizing?
Okay.
And in connection to that, then is optimized, so please help us to understand how to change this mentality to optimizing spiritually. And also, is not optimization a relative term? So would there be multiple ways of optimizing also?
Okay. So, should we spiritually maximize or should we spiritually also optimize? Well, there are two different things over here. In spiritual life, there is a sadhya and there is a sadhan. Sadhya is the goal and sadhan is the means, the process that we follow to get to that goal. So, when I said maximize spiritually means we seek the best goal. Now, we understand Krishna is the highest manifestation of the absolute truth and that Krishna is my goal. So in that sense, we are seeking the biggest goal. So in that sense, I was saying maximizing. But in terms of practicing our bhakti, we will have to optimize. We may like to do some activity a lot. Suppose we like to hear a lot of kirtans. That's good. But then there are many other things also to do in bhakti. If we go to some yatra, we feel, oh, this Vrindavan, Mayapur is so nice. I would like to stay here only. But you know, we can't do that. We have our life, we have our responsibilities, we have our services. So we do have to optimize. So it's talking more in terms of the goal, we don't settle for anything less. We want the best. But in terms of the process, we have our own psychophysical nature, we have our social situation, and we based on that, we have to practice bhakti the best we can in that situation. Okay. And as far as optimizing will be different for different people or in different situations.
Isn't it a relative term?
Is optimization a relative term? Yes. See, relative is, by relative we don't mean that it is just abstract or intangible. Relative means that it will depend on time, place, circumstance. So that means, say, I feel hungry and I want to eat food, but I'll control that desire. Okay, now if it's a day of fasting, then I will control it throughout the day. But if at another time I am feeling hungry and it's time when I take food, then I will decide, okay, I have to do this, but let me take some food and come back and I will continue it. So we may decide sometimes I will delay this for a half an hour, sometimes I may delay it for several hours, sometimes I may deal with it immediately. So depending on time, place, circumstance, we may decide how to deal with a particular situation. So optimization is relative in the sense that we have to see what is the best way ahead in this situation and in progress. Okay?
There will be multiple of them as well.
Yeah, yeah. And for the same person also, optimization will be different at different times. So life is dynamic. So when, say, sometimes if there is some spiritual program, there is some festival, there is some special opportunity for association with some devotees whom we like very much, then we may decide, here I want to focus on this. And I will have to cut down on some other obligations, I have to cut down on some other activities for that time. But sometimes, say, we are working and then there are big deadlines in the project. And then, at that time, we decide, this is what I have to focus on at this time. I have to make sure that this gets done. So, if we are driving on the road, our destination is clear. But depending on how much traffic is there, sometimes we may be able to go fast, sometimes we may go slowly. We keep going in the same direction, but the speed depends on the situation. So similarly, optimizing for us also will vary depending on the traffic in our life. You know, that optimal speed may be different in different situations. Okay?
Thank you.
Yes.
Last question.
Okay.
You said the security, security in relationship with Krishna is achieved, then that real independence will make us interdependent on others. But now this again is like an ideal situation. When that security will be achieved, then till that time, how to again balance the things? Like we can go to the extreme that just ideally feel that I want to be secure with Krishna and in the relationship with Krishna, but it's not happening. So in our this multi-life journey relationships, we may be neglectful or...
Okay, yeah. So, when I said that, when we become we can become dependent on Krishna, that makes us independent, then we can form interdependent relationships. We'll have that security internally. But isn't that too far away? And will that make us, in the intermediate, neglectful or apathetic in our other relationships? Yeah, this is not a linear process, that first I become fully independent and then I become interdependent. It is going to be a parallel process. So, we practice bhakti and we work at our relationships. So, both go together. And sometimes this works very nicely and that this may give me strength for that. When my relationships are peaceful, then I feel more inspired to practice bhakti. Sometimes this may give me strength for this. When I am focused on Krishna, then even there are ups and downs, I am able to deal with it better. So the idea is that we need to keep moving on. And in principle, we understand that the relationship with Krishna is the most important. In practice, we'll have to see how that works for us. Some people are more introverts. For them, they may not have so much need for really interacting with others. Some people may be extroverts. They need more interaction with others. That's fine. We have to deal with our own psychophysical nature and we navigate that territory accordingly. See? Thank you. Yes. Yeah.
Hi, Mr. Kavi. I have two small questions.
Yeah.
First, there's a common saying which we hear a lot in calendars, which comes under Gita, Sati, Jo Hua, Ho Achha Hua, Jo Hoga, Ho Achha Hoga.
Yes.
So, in terms of expectations, it falls under the mode of passion because everything is right. But I would expect it to. Gita to be in the mode of goodness.
Okay, yeah. So there's a Gita, in the Gita Sar it is often said that whatever has happened is good, whatever is happening is good, whatever will happen is good. So, yes, it's surprising, but the Gita Sar doesn't come from the Gita. That Gita Sar is written by someone else, and there is. I have recited the Gita hundreds upon hundreds of times. Never once have I found any verse which comes anywhere near this. Anywhere near this. The Gita is actually not about what happens. It is more about what we do. Arjuna is asking, Pruchhami Twam Dharma Sammuda Cheta. He is asking, O Krishna, how should I act? That is his primary question. Dharma, that is the question. So, now, having said this, that this is not coming from the Gita, still, in the light of the Gita, we can evaluate this. There's a difference between everything that happens is good and everything that happens is for good. The two are different things. Everything that happens is good or everything that happens is for good. Now, actually, Krishna is so expert that even if bad things happen in our life, Krishna can bring good out of it. But it is not that everything that happens is good. When Draupadi was dishonored, nobody came and told her, Jo hua, wo achha hua. No, they didn't say that whatever happened is good. That is a bad thing, terrible thing. And at that level, the Pandavas took action to correct it. Through it all, what happened was, ultimately, through it all, the Pandavas went to the forest and the Kurukshetra war took place. At that time, the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. So, because that was for good. So, it's not that when we are following the Bhagavad Gita, somehow we have to imagine that everything that happens is good. Now, sometimes, bad things happen. We may get some very bad disease, some relationship may get disrupted, we may lose a loved one, we may lose something very important for us. Those are bad things. And we can accept that they are bad. And Krishna says, Dukkheshvan Udvignamana Sukheshvan Gatasruha. One does not become dejected when distress comes, and one doesn't become elated when happiness comes. We can focus on that one should not become dejected, but still the point is, Krishna is acknowledging that sometimes distress can come and sometimes happiness can come. He is acknowledging that these two possibilities are there, that sometimes good will happen, sometimes bad will happen. But if we are focused on Krishna, we won't get so agitated by what happens. We won't get elated, thinking, oh, this is, now everything has gone right. And we won't get devastated, thinking, now everything has gone wrong. Say, okay, this has happened, let me see how I can move on. So the idea that everything that happens is good is, I would not even say in the passion, it's more in ignorance, because it is tamasic. It just means that it's the idea of passivity. I'm not meant to do anything at all. So it is now it is a good sounding message, and sometimes it can bring some positivity to people, but we need to differentiate that everything that happens is not good, everything that happens is for good, and for it to be for good, I also have to respond appropriately. If I don't respond appropriately, then that bad thing may lead to further bad results. So we focus on, okay, whatever has happened, it may be bad, it may be good. What is the best way I can move forward in this situation? Okay? Thank you.
And also in interactions, if you are in the mode of goodness, you can resolve the issues. But the opposite person also has to be in the mode of goodness if I have a conflict. So if he is in the mode of passion, then how do we resolve it?
Okay. So if I am in goodness, but the other person is passion, then how can we resolve the issue?
All in terms of marital conflicts.
Yeah. All in terms of?
Marital conflicts,
yeah. So this is, can we discuss this tomorrow? Because this comes in the part of pursuing. So I'll elaborate on that a little later. Okay, thank you. Yes, we'll come. Can you get the mic behind? You can ask till then. You can ask till then, till the mic goes, you can ask.
I have three questions,
Manoji. Sorry?
Three.
Okay, three one at a time. We'll take one and we'll come back to you afterwards, yeah.
First thing is that when there is a relationship issue with non-devotees or even a personal level, then we may either tolerate or we can deepen the relationship with Krishna and then just make a move on. But when it's connected to the missionary service and we have a relationship with you, issue with the senior devotees who are not responding to the service, how should we deal with such kind of situations? Teachers becoming irresponsible towards the missionary service where we do teamwork.
Okay, all this is related with tomorrow's class.
Okay.
Can you wait?
No.
Okay, I'll talk about this. Yeah.
The second one is when we act in connection with dharma, automatically we see that relationships are spoiled majority of the times.
Relationships are
spoiled when the other person doesn't know how to act on dharma.
Okay, so if we are acting dharmically, the other person is not acting
dharmically. Dharmically, and if we question or if we act on that, and if we take some decisions based on that.
Okay.
In a community, I can say. Not on personal level.
Okay. I think I'll have to address tomorrow's today only then. I'll answer it briefly and we'll elaborate it tomorrow, okay? All these questions, if they're related with how to deal with, say, somebody else, is not acting reasonably. So if we are trying to follow dharma but the other person is not following dharma, as you said, if we are in goodness, the other person is in passion. So broadly speaking, you know, when there is a conflict, there are three ways of dealing with it. We could consider that just as there is, say, the soul is situated in a social environment. So the soul is situated in a bigger atmospheric environment. The soul is situated in the body. So all these three are, the soul is put in a particular situation. Suppose somebody is working in gets a job in some very cold place like Melbourne. Say, right in the south of Australia. And it's very cold over there. That's very difficult to deal with that cold. So basically, there are three options. So, tolerate, mitigate, or emigrate. Okay, I just tolerate, I get used to it. This is the way the atmosphere is. And sometimes if you stay for some time, the body gets adapted to it. Mitigate means, okay, now I get as many warm clothes as possible. I try to make sure that my car has good heating, my home has good heating. I try to work to rectify the situation. Or, I cannot tolerate, I immigrate. So, these three options are all valid. And they may all be chosen at different situations. Similarly, with respect to relationships, when there are conflicts, there are some situations in which we tolerate. Okay, you know, this person is like this. It is troubling me, but it is not really, it's not unbearable. I can live with it. So I tolerate it and move on. Then, say a simple example is if we are driving in a, if we are going, say, by a local,
crowded local we are traveling. And then we are standing in one corner and somebody comes and keeps pushing us. You know, that person is trying to push. Now we may push back. And you think you are very strong, I am also strong. That person pushes us, we push back. We push, that person push. And we get so caught in pushing each other that we forget our destination has come. And then we just get still caught over there. No, there's no need. Okay, you're pushing. You want that space? Okay, I'll just move a little bit. I might get a little cramped, but how long am I here? It's a small thing. So I tolerate it and I just move on with my life, get off. But if that person starts pushing me out of the train itself, then I can't tolerate that. You know, I have to mitigate. I have to push back. Maybe I have to call attention to other people and then they have to help me. So there is tolerance which is required, but that also has a limitation to it. It's not that tolerance is the supreme virtue. It's an important virtue, but tolerance has to be seen in the light of the purpose. The purpose is I have to get to this destination. So if just by just moving a little bit aside, I can get to the destination more peacefully, fine. But if that person pushes me out, I won't get to the destination. So then I have to fight back. So similarly for us, say when we are in the mode of goodness, then we bring the best to the table. When we act dharmically, we bring the best to the table. How the other person is going to respond is not in our control. But if the other person, what that person is doing is troubling us, but it is a bearable trouble. In the light of the bigger purpose that we have to achieve, this is a small inconvenience. We can manage with it. Then we tolerate and we move on. But sometimes if that is causing so much trouble that we can't move towards our destination itself. Now we are trying to do some service, we are trying to promote, go forward in that relationship. But that is causing so much problem that our bigger purposes are getting interrupted. Then we may need to be more active, mitigate. Mitigate can be that we may report to somebody higher. If our superior is not doing it right, then we report to their superior. And we try to tame, or we go and talk with them in a respectful way. We take some action to correct the situation. So one is tolerate the situation. Mitigate means correct the situation. But we find that if we try to raise that issue, then again people only speak badly about us, people give us a bad name, or things become more complicated. Then we just exit the situation. Okay, you know, this is not working out, so I'm going to move away from here. I'll do some other service. And ultimately I have to serve Krishna. So I'll move on in my service to Krishna. So if we focus on that goal that I am meant to serve Krishna, and I have to serve through this relationship. But if I can't serve this relationship, then what do I do? I can either tolerate it and move on. Otherwise, I have to mitigate it. If I can't, then I migrate. So, I'll elaborate on these three options with examples in tomorrow's class. But these are the three broad options that we have. Okay.
And my third doubt is, it is generally said that before going back to Godhead, one should not have any relationship issue with anyone, even a single person. I have from many people, senior devotees. Is it possible? Because we may have worked upon it, and we may not have any negative feelings towards anyone who may have done bad towards us. But it is not the case with others also. So is it really possible, okay, or how to work upon it?
Okay. So is it that to go back to Godhead, we should not have any negative interaction with anyone? It's more of what is our consciousness. We see Srila Prabhupada, before he departed from the world, when many of his godbrothers came to meet him, he said that, you know, for the sake of preaching, sometimes I had to speak many things. If I spoke anything inappropriately, please forgive me. Prabhupada said that, I am a very fallen soul, you please have mercy on me. I am Mahapatit. And his godbrother said, no, Swamiji, you are not Mahapatit. Swami Maharaj, you are Mahapatit Pavan. So they appreciated it. But Prabhupada, they showed an example that in the final days, if we have spoken negatively to someone, if we have had some negative interactions, we seek forgiveness and we try to set the record straight from our side. Now, whether the other person forgives or not, that is up to them. So basically, I would say that it's not so much of that we should have good relationship with everyone. That's not possible. Because just different people are different. And it may not be possible to have warm, intimate relationship with everyone. But at least what we should not have is
such a strong irritation or animosity or anger towards someone, that at the time of death, instead of thinking of going to Krishna, we are thinking of getting even with that person. Then we will remember that person, and that person did this to me. Then that's bad. So basically, our consciousness should focus on Krishna. So generally we say attachment we should not have. No, attachment can distract us from Krishna. If you are too attached to someone, we'll think about that person and then we'll not be able to think about Krishna. But Krishna often talks about raga and dvesha together. Raga dvesha vimukta is too. He says in 2.64. So attachment can distract us from Krishna, but aversion can also distract us from Krishna. If I'm too averse to someone, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, how dare this person speak like this? Krishna, Krishna, I'll get back at this one. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, next time. Then we're not really able to practice bhakti. So that just as we want to become free from attachment, we also want to become free from aversion. So what it is said is that we should not be averse to anyone. Now whether that person becomes favorable to us or not, that's not in our control. But we want to prevent the aversion from becoming a distraction in our bhakti. Okay? Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Personally, I feel a lot of times we don't give enough time for processing, we just perceive and we react. So how should we ensure that we actually practically guidance on how to process, spend more time processing than we react?
Okay. So how can we spend more time processing than reacting? Generally, we think of action in terms of activity. I'm doing this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. But we also sometimes need to learn that pause is also an action word. So somebody says play, stop, pause. So sometimes when somebody has irritated us and we feel like exploding, at that time we might just decide pause. Not that I deny what I'm feeling, not that I deny what this person has done wrong, but I'm not going to react immediately. Pause. So if we can learn to develop our own pause button, that means we observe ourselves and see what are the situations in which we get provoked, in which we react in unhealthy ways. And then after we have observed and learned that, then at least understood these situations I get provoked, then we can find out how can I check myself. So we may decide, okay, that time when I'm feeling angry, I take deep breaths. Instead of immediately, I take deep breaths. Or I may decide, I may chant. Or I may decide, you know, that I'll just walk away from there. And then maybe I have read something about anger or something. I'll try to remember that. I'll reread that. Or I just recite some verses or whatever. So sometimes walking away from a situation, maybe what is the best way of pausing it? This is just becoming too exasperating. We'll deal with it later, not now. So now pausing is not easy, and how we will pause will vary from person to person. So basically, yesterday I talked about if the floor is inclined, the water is naturally going to flow in this way. So for us to reconstruct the whole floor in the other direction is quite difficult. But if there is a small wedge or a small slot where there is a hole where the water can go in that direction, then I can't stop the water from flowing in this direction. But if I just put the water into that slot, it will go in that direction. So like that, we have certain default behaviors. But if we find out that there is some activity in bhakti which captivates us, in which we can get easily absorbed, then we can keep that activity readily accessible for us. So it may be reciting verses, it may be chanting, it may be just looking at a picture of a deity, of our favorite deity in the favorite dress or whatever. So then that's like a slot which we can push the consciousness away from there. So pause is also an action word. So pausing is not just don't do anything, but choose a healthier course of action at that time. And then that, when our consciousness moves away from that pressure situation towards Krishna, then we become calmer. And then when we are calmer, then we can, instead of reacting, we can respond. Okay? Thank you. Yes. Anybody else? We'll come back to you. Anybody else has questions? Yes, bro.
Like,
we'll come. You can ask. I'll repeat.
So, I have a question based on yesterday's and today's class. Like yesterday, somebody asked you how a mood influence, and you said based on 3 points, and that's the intentions, impressions, and situation.
Yeah.
And today also, we discussed the point about karma plus dhaiva plus kala result in the phala. So if I'm doing some activity, like let's take an example, some spiritual activity, like if I want to get up early in the morning and chant, but if I am not able to do it, even though if I have intention, if I am trying for years, but somehow one or another situation is taking into account. So, like, is it fair to, like, enough for me to decide whether it's less of my intention which is hampering the situation, or my past impressions, or past karma, or daiva and kala, they are affecting the situation? What is that? Is it my, is my intentions are less, or my karma is less?
Yeah. So, if we are facing some negative situation, then how do we know whether it is that I am not endeavoring hard enough, that's why this problem is coming, or this is just by destiny and I can't do anything, I have to accept it. Yeah, this is something which will vary based on time, place, and circumstance. So, in all situations, there are some things in our control and some things out of our control. But how much is in our control and how much is outside our control, that will vary from person to person and from situation to situation. So, suppose say I am giving a class. Then, when I am going to give a class, what I speak on is in my control. But what question the audience asks is not in my control. So, I can prepare nicely for what I speak, but what the audience is going to ask, that's not in my question. I will try to answer to the best of my knowledge at that time. So, for us, we all have to recognize in this situation, if somebody is playing a tennis match. In tennis, sometimes the player is serving and sometimes the player is returning. When the player is serving, at that time, they have much more freedom. They can decide to serve with the forehand, backhand, what height to serve, into the body, how much spin to apply, whatever. They have all these variations. Now, when they are returning, they don't have much freedom. Now, a player may be very good on the forehand, but if the server has come on the backhand, you can't play on the forehand. You just hit the air at that time. So, at that time, so when they're serving, the control is much more. When they're returning, the control is much lesser. Wherever the ball comes, you just have to get it back into the court. So you try to get it back as well as possible. But that's all that you can do at that time. So, in our life, sometimes we are serving. That means, you know, we have to take the initiative. We can decide where to focus the energy, how to prioritize, how to organize. In some situations, we are returning. Just life is throwing things at us, and you just have to cope with them and deal with them. So, in what situation we are serving and what we are returning, that we may require a little distance from the situation to understand. So, sometimes in the heat of the situation, we may default to our habitual tendency. So if our habitual tendency is a little bit in the mode of ignorance, say, it's not in my control, just let me give up. If our habitual tendency is in the mode of passion, we may over-endeavor, I'll get this right no matter how much it happens. I'm just going to do this. So sometimes somebody wants to crack an exam. Somebody wants to get to pass IIT and go to IIT. They may try 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. And then you have to move on with your life. If somebody spends 10 years trying to get into JEE itself, when are you going to get your graduation? I decide this is not going to work. Let me just, okay, I tried 2-3 times. And life doesn't end because I don't have an IIT degree. You can still get some degree in some other college, I can move on. So we have to use, as I said again, if you have a broader perspective of things, what is it that I ultimately want to achieve? Then we can, if we have that purpose clear, then we get a perspective. How much is this worth endeavoring? And how much is, sometimes we say, this is just, okay, I've done enough in this, it's not working out, let me more. So if we can distance ourselves from the situation and look at that situation in the light of our ultimate purpose, then we can decide whether we should keep endeavoring, we should try to endeavor more, or we should just try to accept it as destiny and move on. Okay, thank you. So last question, and we'll stop.
In the last question, you mentioned about the getting angry. We do not deny what we feel and the pause. The question is that who's getting angry and who's talking to whom? Who's asking us to pause when we are doing this communication?
Okay. So when we are saying that we should pause and not deny our anger but don't act on it. So who is it that is feeling anger and who is saying that we should not express the anger or whatever? Basically, within us there are multiple voices. The soul is the source of consciousness. The soul is the ultimate chooser. But the soul can choose, as I said, the voice of emotion or the voice of reason. We can say the voice of, we can say roughly that the voice of emotion comes from the mind, the voice of reason comes from the intelligence. Now, the depending on different people's psychophysical nature, depending on their spiritual evolution, you know, one voice may be very strong. Say for people in the mode of passion, they know, so the voice of emotion may be very strong. The voice of reason may be very less. So the mind is also inside us, it is our mind. So, okay, I'm feeling angry now. I have to acknowledge that I'm feeling angry. I can't suppress or bury my emotions. Anger also indicates that we care. So, anger, when do we get angry about something? When something is important for us. And when that has not worked out. So, anger indicates that we care for it. But then that care as an emotion is important, but care as an action has to be expressed appropriately. So, okay, I'm feeling angry right now, and that is the, so the mind is expressing the emotion of anger. So as the soul, I acknowledge that emotion. Okay, this, my mind is feeling like this right now, but there is an intelligence which observes. Okay, but right now expressing this is not the best way to do it. So let's take this out to the level of the body. Say right now, and maybe I'm sitting on a chair and feel, no, I'm getting a little cramped sitting for 2 hours now. I need to get up. Okay. So the body is sending a signal. You have to get up now. That is one voice that is coming within us. But then we can also say that, okay, we can, okay, yeah, I'm feeling some pain over here. But we can use our intelligence, okay, but do I really need to get up? Or can I just move myself a little bit? Or can I, this class is going to end in a few minutes, so can I tolerate for a few minutes? So basically, there is, if we are feeling something, it's from the body, mind, where it is, we acknowledge it. So the soul acknowledges what is feeling, but then they use the intelligence to evaluate whether that feeling needs to be immediately acted on or how that feeling should be acted on. So the mind, intelligence and the soul, all three are involved in this. Okay. Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhaktivrinda ki, Jai Gaur Premanande.